1 Timothy. Appreciate you being here tonight. And hope and pray and give you something to maybe tide you over now. We left off. Look, if you will, please. We'll pick it up in verse number 17. Verse number 17. And this is where we were. The Bible says, "Now unto King eternal, immortal, invisible, the only wise God." Now, I get a question about that. They say, "The only wise God." You mean there's more than one? Yes. 2 Corinthians 4:4 says, "The God of this world." In the book of Psalms, he says, individuals were thought of as gods, he said, "But you shall die like men." In some places, they're talked about in Acts chapter number 3 or 4 or 5, right along in there. No, it'll be later than that. It'll be them walking around, Paul going in there with Silas. And he said, "The gods have come down." Maybe that's around 17. He said, "The gods have come down among us." And they're referring to Mercurius and Jupiter. They're referring to angels that came down, fallen angels that came down. I have to say this about that. I know you're standing. Give me a second. I've been hearing a lot of this stuff about the devil being an angel. The devil's not an angel. The devil is a cherub. And the devil is the fifth cherub that covers. That's in Ezekiel chapter number 1, Ezekiel chapter 28, and in Isaiah chapter number 14. He's not an angel. He can appear as an angel of light, 2 Corinthians chapter 11. But he is not an angel. Don't ever mistake that. He's a cherub. He's a shapeshifter, though. He can change the way he looks and what he does. His influence is over ministers in pulpits. Don't get this mistaken idea that when you're battling with the devil that you have to go to the strip club or to the movie house or to the drunken bars or to the family fights and all that kind of stuff. The devil likes to hang around religious things. Where you see the most manifestation of the devil is in and around religious things. He wants worship. That's what the devil's interested in. Now he says, "The only wise God, be honor and glory forever and ever. Amen. This charge I commit unto thee, son Timothy, according to the prophecies which were before thee, that thou by them mightest war a good warfare." That's where we were the other day, and I'm going to give you these other verses on it. And then he says, "Holding faith and a good conscience, with some having put away, having have made a shipwreck." And then he brings up a doctrinal thing again. Verse number 20, "Of whom is Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I have delivered unto Satan, that they may learn not to blaspheme." Brother Honeyfield, you pray. Brother Matthew, and ask the Lord to help us, would you please? Amen. Thank you. You can have a seat. Take your Bible, if you will, please, and come to 2 Timothy chapter 2. Now, this is just practical stuff. We're talking about Christian character. Christian character is the ability to do things you're supposed to do even when you don't want to. Character is defined simply as this, not giving you a Webster's 1828 definition of it. Let me define character for it. Character is one of those kind of things that makes you get out of bed when you don't want to get out of bed. It makes you eat the food you don't want to eat or not eat the food you don't want to eat. Character is the kind of thing that causes you to do what you're supposed to do even when the circumstances or the situation doesn't seem conducive to do what's right. You can tell a lot about a man by the amount of character, how he exhibits character. In other words, when he's under pressure, when he is required to do things that are right to do or things that he should do that are right, you can see a man's character borne out as to no matter what the consequences are, he's willing to do what's right to do because it's right to do. I had a talk with a friend of mine not long ago, and the illustration of character is this. David and Saul just happens to be in my notes for tonight. Coincidence, probably. But David and Saul, you say both of them messed up. They did. They both messed up. David committed adultery and murder. Saul committed all kind of murders and lying and cheating and stealing and taking people's property and taking people's things and ruling like a stinking till of the Hun and killing innocent people and killing the priest. He killed 70 priests in one swat over there just because they gave David a sword and some bread. I mean, you talk about wicked. Saul is a wicked man. Here's the difference. When the Lord came to Saul, Saul tried the cover-up. I call it the kitty in the litter box theology. Saul's character is what showed up. Not his ability as a soldier, not his ability as a king, not his ability to do what's right to do. Saul's character was on trial when the Lord said, "You're caught." And Saul said, "The people." 2 Samuel chapter 15. He said, "Did you do what God told you to do?" "Well, preacher, I did. I performed it." He said, "Well, what's the bleating of the sheep, the lowing of oxen in mine ear?" He goes, "Well, the people wanted to keep the best for the breeding stock and stuff. And, you know, I mean, I still did what the Lord wanted me to do, but I'm a pleaser of the people also." "Well, let me ask you, what about Agag?" "Well, I got him on a long chain." I mean, isn't capturing him, isn't holding on to him, isn't having him under control, isn't that as good as killing him? I mean, after all, you know, we're kings and we understand, but you know, after all, what a great trophy to have on a chain. And anytime anybody wants to know who's a great king, I can just pull out Agag and tell me who's a great king. And guess what happens? Samuel calls him out on it, and when Samuel calls him out on him, you know what he does? He finally catches him, and he says this. I'm in 1 Samuel 15. Here's the first thing he says. He says, well, okay, all right, okay, look, I did it. Here comes the deal making. Now, that's between me and you, okay, but don't tell the people. You see, what's on display is not just lying, cheating, conniving, and all that other stuff. It's his character. It's a fault in his character. David messes up. Bathsheba's up there taking a shower. He's where he shouldn't be. And he looked, and anybody would look. You men and women, both of you look. Where David made the problem was, as he looked, then he stared, and then he began to contemplate it. James chapter number 1, and three, and he began to think about it, and that sin began to get illuminated in his mind. He began to ponder, and began to figure a way to get it to happen. The next thing you know, he inquires, and the inquiry comes back in the negative. That's somebody else's wife. He should have said, okay, Holy Spirit's already warned me once, and now that belongs to somebody else, so I got to stop. Instead, he said, okay, well, let's just have her over for dinner. You know, she looks a little poor and emaciated, and she probably wouldn't mind having a good dinner. I mean, after all, her husband's out there, and she's probably lonely, and I got all this at my disposal. I don't know how he all worked it out, but the next thing you know, she's in the palace, and before she leaves the palace, she's got a child. So you know what transpired there. And so all of a sudden, David is caught in a bad situation. Then on top of that, when Uriah the Hittite comes home, he tries to get Uriah to go in. So there's conniving going on. He's trying to set Uriah. If I can get Uriah home from the battlefield quick enough to get in there, they'll never be able to count the days when the rabbit died. So they'll be able to, and then I'll think it's Uriah's baby and all will be good. And Uriah is such an upright man. He's such a solid individual that when he comes up there, he won't even go sleep with his wife. He won't even go to the house so that there's not even a chance for that to happen. He goes to sleep on the porch. So then David, against trying to connive, then David comes in there. We're talking about character. David steps in there and he gets him drunk. And then he figures, well, now that he's drunk, there's no way he is not going to be pleasing his flesh, because now his conscience is down, and now his ability to prevent himself is there's a word I'm looking for there, but his stopgap is gone, his pressure switch is completely gone. And so guess what happens? He goes to sleep out on the front porch, and the king comes out the next morning. Hey, man, how you doing? Fine. You go to the house last night? Why are you so interested in that, king? No, I didn't go to the house. My buddies are out there on the battlefield and stuff, where you should be. But they're out on the battlefield. It's not right for me to go home and enjoy being with my wife when my buddies are out there where you should be. And so, no, sir, I didn't go home. I slept right out here on the porch. And David, the next thing you know, is in his office, and he's writing out a letter, and he calls in a individual there, and he says, I need some wax in my ring. So what do you got there? I got a sealed edict. I want this to go to Joab and Joab only. And he said, well, I don't know. He said, I don't know who you could give it to. And the king said, well, who would you give it to trust? So he said, oh, man, I know who that is. Give it to Uriah the Hittite, man. That's the most trustworthy servant you got, even though he's not a Jew. And the knife goes in a little bit. And David writes that thing, and in that thing he says, I want you to do whatever you have to do to kill Uriah the Hittite. Don't ask me any questions. I'm King David, and it don't make any difference, and you're going to be a part of this, or I'll kill you. And seals up that letter, rolls it up, takes the wax, drips it on there, stamps it on there, and he says, hey, Uriah, can you do me a favor? Yes, sir, King, whatever you want me to do. He said, would you take off when you go back to the battlefield? I need you to stop by the command tent over there. I need you to hand this message to Joab. Yes, sir, King. Your will be done. No problem. Off to the battlefield he goes. He's, by the way, King, probably don't know you. We live next door over here. If you could, if you happen to see my wife, tell her I said hello. Sorry, I couldn't drop by to see her. Be something like that. And he takes off running. He gets back to the battlefield and grabs his helmet and grabs his shield and grabs his sword and his spear. And he stands over there. He's standing outside the door of the tent as he would like this. And then all of a sudden Joab comes in. He snaps to attention. Joab walks by. So what do you want? He said, the king has an order for you. And he bows like this and he hands it to him. And he said, just stand by a minute. And he stands there at parade rest probably and just stands there looking at the floor like you're supposed to. And he's waiting. And Joab begins to read that thing. And then he looks up at Uriah. And then he looks back down at the letter. And he's thinking, what in the cat hair did you do to cause the king to say to kill you? He said, okay, man. He said, well, you've had a little bit of rest now and you've had a good time up there at the king's palace and all that other kind of stuff. I guess you probably had a chance to get with your wife and all that kind of deal. Hope you had a great time. No, sir, I didn't get a chance to see my wife. I was at the king's palace. And what do you mean you're at the king's palace? I slept on the doorpost out there, out the thing, and I ate good and I drank a little too much and all that. But yes, sir, I'm ready. He goes, well, we got a big charge tomorrow. I want you to take off out there. I tell you what, it's good to have you back, Uriah. I'll let you be the leader of the band and I want you to get up there as close to the wall as you possibly can and maybe we'll take over. He doesn't even question the order. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Absolutely. Boy, that character of Uriah would preach a whole sermon in and of itself. And that man grabs that thing, and the next day he comes out there. That night he gets up there, and the boys are out there sitting around that campfire. Their faces are glowing, and that fire's popping and crackling, and they're sharpening their weapons and getting them ready and making sure their leggings are good and tight and that kind of deal, getting prepared for a big battle. They know it's going to be a bad one because they're going to be closing in close to the city, and they know it's going to be hot. And they're making sure everything is done the best they possibly can. And Joab walks up there. Uriah walks up there, and he said, guys, the general told me that I'm in charge. They said, oh man, that's great. Man, we've been watching you fight. You're a good man. We don't have any problem following you. And he said, well, here's what we're going to do. You know, I'm going to lead the attack and we're going to go in. I'm not going to lead from the rear. I'm not going to lead from the bivouac back here. I'm not going to lead from back in HQ. I'm going to be right out there in front. I'll be right there with you. And they're all like, hoorah, we're right there with you, Uriah. No problem. We're right there. Boy, I mean, we're all over it, man. I mean, they huddle together, man. They have a word of prayer together. Boy, we're going to go out here. We're going to be like old Caleb was. We're going to climb up over the top of the gutter over there and go in and take the city, man. Oh, yeah, man, this is going to be great. And in their mind, boy, they're out there fighting, boy, like David's mighty men. And they saddle up the next morning and get ready to go out. And you can hear those feet stomping on that ground and that dust flying, boy. And they're going out and that adrenaline is beginning to pump so much. Their ears are beginning to ring and their eyes are even getting somewhat blurry because they can't process all of that adrenaline going through them. And they stomp out there on that field. And boy, the battle is set in array and that kind of stuff. And Uriah turns around to his guys. He said, you guys ready to go? They said, we're right here with you. But during the night, Joab had come in. And during the night, he went to everyone in Uriah the Hittite squad and said, I'm going to have y'all lead the battle. And when he gets up there close to the wall, he said, when he gets overtaken and swarmed, I want y'all to back off and leave him alone. Joab, the big general, who can't disagree with that. And he said, if the enemy doesn't kill you, I'll cut your tongue out and hang you up and skin you like a deer. I'll do you like I did Amasa. I'll leave you laying in the middle of the road and your guts poured out, and I'll let you die a long, slow death. Yes, sir, General, they say. Boy, the whole time they're following behind Uriah, they're watching that man getting ready to go marching to his death, and they know for a fact they're going to that death, but they're following those orders. And they watch the character of Uriah walk out there and engage that battle. And man, I mean, he is slinging it down. He is fighting like a madman. Looks like a chainsaw going through butter. He is waylaying them back and forth and sideways and stuff like that. And he gets up there next to the wall. He's thinking, man, if I can just get a foothold here and I can get up that wall. And then all of a sudden he starts to kind of get overwhelmed, looks like ants getting on a carcass. And he turns around and he looks, and all the guys in his squad are headed the other direction. And they're leaving him there. And down comes a stone from off the wall and crushes his brains out. And the last sight that man sees is his friends deserting him. My goodness, man, can you imagine? Guys, what did I do? You said you were with me. Would you leave me up here? Well, the first runner goes running back. I know you know the story, but I'd like to finish telling it, and we get back to the message here in just a second. First runner goes back there, and he gets running in there, and how's the battle going? Well, you know, the battle got pretty hot, and we kind of got turned around and so on and so forth. You know a guy named Uriah? Yeah? Yes, sir, sure do, King. What happened to him? Well, he's dead. How'd that happen? Well, he got too close to the wall. Well, David says, well, you know what? That's how the battle goes, you know. That's how war is, you know. Doesn't he know from reading the old accounts of war, you can't get too close to the wall, somebody drops something on you and kill you? I mean, he should have known better than that. Well, that's the way battle is. Okay, thank you. Dismissed. And David said, I'm good. And then time passes, as time will do, and sometimes it goes by like a clock without hands on it. And David's having a hard time getting some sleep, and the next thing you know, that woman looks like she swallowed a watermelon seed. She comes waddling into the palace, and she says, we got a problem. And he said, well, don't worry about it. I raise it in my own kid. Don't worry about it. I'm not going to desert you. We're down, baby. We're good. Don't you sweat it. Don't you worry about it at all. Everything's good. Don't you worry. He's still in cover-up. And the baby's born. And the baby dies. And the Lord says, hey, boy. Not hello, king. Not hey, the head of Israel. The anointed one. Hey, shepherd boy, sonny boy, do you forget who you are? What in the world? He goes and weeps and cries and bawls and squalls. You know what the Lord said? That baby's going to die. So you can quit your crying. David gets up and washes himself off and he said, the baby's not coming to us, but I'm coming to the baby. And it gets quiet for a while. David figures, well, okay, that's part of the deal. Yeah, but David, didn't you say four sheep for a sheep? We ain't done yet, boy. That's what you said. Four sheep for a sheep. Psalm 51 is David under that pressure. And time goes on and David figures time heals all wounds. Everything's going to be okay. But there's something happening between David and the Lord. The communication's not there. The messages aren't coming. The leadership, the directions are not coming. There's an odd feeling when he walks into the church. It just don't feel right. And Bathsheba, because Uriah's dead now, she doesn't move to the palace. She's the big cheese now. She's one of the many. She's in there. Looks like, hey, everything's okay. And the Lord begins one day to say, hey, man, how about you? You know what he says in Psalm 51? Against thee and thee only have I sinned. And he mentions all the stuff in Psalm 51 about his transgressions. You say, why do you bring that up? The difference in David and Saul is one man saw himself in front of God and the other man saw himself in front of men. And Saul continued to justify himself until the day he died because he had no character. And Saul was a big man, and Saul was a strong man. As a matter of fact, the Bible said he was head and shoulders above all the others. So he was taller than most people and bigger and broad-shouldered. But he didn't have enough character to fill a thimble. And he was the king of the nation of Israel. The definition of character is I got to do what's right in God's sight. It doesn't matter what happens to me. Look quickly at Psalm 51. Just allow me to deviate for just a second here. I'm talking about war and a good warfare. Is this making any sense to you? See, there's more at stake going on here. You do realize that David winds up being in charge as a prince in the millennium and then in charge after the millennium, after the great white throne. As a matter of fact, Jesus Christ comes from the line of David. But the difference fundamentally in David and Saul is David had the character to say, I don't care what the repercussions are. I'm going to do what's right to do. I'm going to take my medicine. And Saul's like, is there another way out? Can we fix this? Preacher, just keep it between me and you now. And Samuel begins to back out like that. He said, I can't do that, man. Not after what you've done. You've taken the priest office on you. You remind me of Uriah over there. What do you mean, Uzzah over there. What did Uzziah do? He went in and tried to take over the priesthood when it wasn't for him to take over. And the preachers tried to tell him and he wouldn't listen. Saul, you're like that. Saul said, I don't know who he's talking about. He ain't like that. I mean, I'm a good king. I don't know who would think otherwise. If they think otherwise, kill them. That's what he did. You help my enemy, I'll kill you. My goodness, man. Saul almost thought he put himself on the throne. I'm sure you're not like that. You know, you want to assassinate whoever's against you. But you got to remember, you're where you are because God put you there. And so if you have to defend a position that you have, then you know what David does? I'll show you character. King, your son Absalom's coming after you. He's got an army with him. I mean, he's got a ton of them. And most of what you got around you now is a bunch of old men been around you for all this time. They might have been of valor in those days, but man, them days are gone. Their swords are rusty, boy. Their spears are dull. They don't even have shields. They can't even hold them anymore. And David said, okay, well, I wasn't planning on fighting to keep it anyway. So what do you mean you're not going to fight to keep the throne? He says, "Not, never was mine. It belongs to the Lord. I'm show you character. That's what I'm trying to demonstrate to you." So what do you mean it belongs to the Lord? The Lord gave me the throne. He can take it away if he wants to. I kind of have to agree with the Lord. Lord, give it. Lord, take it away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And we receive good things from the Lord. Shall we not receive evil things, bad things? Why not? I mean, you know, maybe the Lord's done with me. It's not my business. It's his throne. I'm not going to try to protect it any more than I tried to take it. I'm not going to try to keep it. That's character. Well, King, you don't understand, man. I mean, this long-haired ragamuffin man, I mean, you know, he looks like he's in Hutari or he looks like he's in the Rastafarians or something, man. I mean, he's got hair so long down there, people are paying big money to get a lock of his hair when he pulls it at the end of every year, counts it out, lays it out there at the gate. He's been sitting in the gate kissing people and talking to people. And King said, yeah, I'm aware of that. And he said, well, what you want to do? Let's get up, muster up an army. We can shut the inner gates and he'll have to take it by siege. And we got enough stuff in here to last us 3 years. He'll never last that long and all that. And David said, no, leave the gates open. Matter of fact, leave the back gate open. Get the people, get their stuff. Let's get out of here. He thinks he's ready to be the king. Let him have it. Yeah. You say, what is that? That's character. That's the Lord put me here. So guess what happened? The Lord lets him leave the kingdom, leave the palace. And he goes out there. Just a little story about David. He walks out across the palace. You say, why? That happened after this. David's seen God's mercy. David says to his inner circle, he says, if that boy thinks he's ready for the kingdom and he has to take it by force, he didn't learn anything from me. So you know what I'm going to do? I'll let him have it because the Lord may be done with me. Maybe I'm getting what I deserve. I ain't got no business being here anyway. You know, that's fine. Well, Lord, I was just a shepherd boy. Never was more than a shepherd boy. Never saw myself as more than a shepherd boy. Every time I did, it cost somebody their life. When I started thinking to myself more than I ought to think about myself, let him have it. Yes, sir, you're the king. Out they go. They hadn't got outside the gate, I mean, I don't know, maybe a quarter of a mile or so, and here comes this fool running down off the rocks up there, out of the mountains, out of the hills. He's got rocks in his hands. He's throwing rocks and dirt at the king and calling him all kind of names and cussing him out. And Abishai begins to get mad and gritting his teeth. And he's getting really, really angry now and frustrated because he knows the king personally. He's thinking, man, let me go take this dead dog's head. But he has to stop and ask the king first. He said, I'm going to go take him off and kill him like the dead dog he is. You know what the king said? I'll show you character. You know what the king said? Let him cuss. Maybe the Lord will grant me a blessing by getting cussed out even though I don't deserve it. David probably looks at that old boy Abishai and he said, man, if you knew about me what God knows about me, you'd know every word he's saying is an absolute truth and you wouldn't fight against it at all. Let him cuss, he says. Maybe the Lord will requite me a blessing. Well, you know what winds up happening. Absalom winds up not getting all the way into the throne. The next thing you know, he's swinging from a tree up there, got running off of his donkey and got hung up there by his hair. You can call it his pride or whatever you want to call it. And Joab goes over there and sticks darts through him and stuff. And now he's dead. And David goes back in and says, well, I guess if nobody else wants it, I'll take the throne. You say, what is that? That's character. That's the epitome of letting God control your destiny. You hear all this destiny preaching, all this stuff. If you do this, God don't have to do nothing. God don't have to do nothing. Watch, David's in a mess right here. And it's been almost a year since he sinned with Bathsheba. So he's waited long enough for it to work out. It ain't working out. You know, the Bible says, be sure your sin will find you out. It's true. Sometimes if you confess it early and get it behind you, the Lord will keep it hidden. Won't he? The Lord ain't exposed everything you've ever done, has he? You say, why? Keep short accounts. Right? David's waited a year. It hadn't helped him. So here's David before the Lord. You can read all this later on. Notice, have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, according to the multitude of thy tender mercies. Blot out my transgression. He's personal. Wash me thoroughly of mine iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin. I acknowledge my transgressions. My sin is ever before me. Thee only have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight, that thou mightest be justified when thou speakest and be clear when thou judgest. Behold, I was shapen in iniquity, so on and so forth. Desire truth in the inward part. Purge me with hyssop. Wash me now, and I'll be whiter than snow. Make me hear the joy and the gladness. And then all the things from there to the end of the passage of stuff he's lost while he's been out of fellowship with the Lord. You say, why? David had a lapse in character. But when push came to shove, the difference in David and Saul is, David said, I've sinned against God. Whether I sinned against Uriah, whether I sinned against Bathsheba, whether I sinned against the dead baby, whether I sinned against Tamar, whether I sinned against Absalom, whether I sinned against the nation of Israel, whether I've given the nation of Israel cause to laugh, mock, and make fun, and the enemies of Israel to rejoice over our wickedness, my sins against God. You know what Saul said? I got a way out. And Saul winds up after consorting with a witch, because that's where it goes. Did you ever think about that? You ever consider that at all? Maybe you haven't. Let me just give you something to think about. Why would Saul, after he went to the prophets and the prophets aren't talking to him, and Saul is the one that clearly knows that it is wrong to consort with a witch. Is that right? Because he has them banned. Is that correct? Witches and warlocks and them that peep and so on. Right? He has them all banned based upon what the law said. Now ask yourself this question. Why then would Saul, immediately after the prophets don't speak to him, find himself in front of a witch looking for an answer? Because when you continue to create the pattern is a downward spiral, and before long, instead of hearing from God, now you're looking to hear from the devil because you're desperate to hear from somebody. You say, I'll never be that way. Time wouldn't permit me, ladies and gentlemen, to take the time tonight to tell you how many times I've seen people, kids and old alike, that started off the right kind of way and got their hind end on their shoulders about something or got caught doing something, and then they start getting counsel from individuals and from people in the wrong direction, and the next thing you know, they're doing things you would never dream of. You say, what is it? It's another spirit. That's why it's mentioned in 1 Samuel 15. They go to counsel and they get the right kind of counsel when people are telling them what they want to hear. And compliance is in line with what they want to do. But here's what happens. When the counsel doesn't change, but the person refuses to listen to the counsel that was good before, something's happened. Not with the counsel, the person. And the person has now made a decision that, whereas you were my go-to person before, you're no longer my person. Why? Because what's being revealed is the character. You really only had good counsel when you told me what I wanted to hear. And now you make your mind up, I'm going to do what I want to do. And so what you're looking for is not counsel, but condonement. So you'll go to the person that you trusted all the time to give you this counsel, and it didn't really wrinkle your feathers too much. It didn't ruffle your feathers. It didn't really ruffle your feathers too much. And now you have something you want to do, and what you're looking for is you want that person that's been counseling you to condone what you're doing and to go ahead and say, hey, I'm with you. And when that person says, I don't think that's a good idea for the following reasons. That's Saul. His counselors were only valuable if they learned to give him counsel based upon what he wanted to do. I feel bad about calling you kids, but I'm old enough to call you kids. I don't mean to be offensive. And I realize, you know, like the little girl, she had these little things hanging out here, hair tied out here. And I said, I like your pigtails. And she started crying. And she went to her mother. And her mother, I probably have already told you this story, but I'm getting halftime or so. And her mother came up to me and she said, Brother Peacock, what's the matter? I said, I don't know. I told her I liked her pigtails. She said, oh. I'm like, oh? Well, what do you mean? She goes, well, we teach our kids to call them braids because when you're saying pigtails, you're in effect calling her a pig. And remember I told you on Sunday that sometimes another part of you comes up and you have like three choices? Yes. Yeah, I have those. And one of them kind of started winning the race. And I'm like, oh, Lord, help me, help me. I'm like Nehemiah praying it big time. Help me, Lord, help, Lord, help me. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm really very sorry. I certainly didn't think your daughter was a pig. I thought her mother was. No, I thought. I said, I apologize. I looked at the little girl and I said, look, when I was growing up, that was like we were saying, it was very cute. And in my day, they called them pigtails. And so I'll call them braids from now on. Gag me with a spoon, man. So when I say kids, I don't mean offense, but I want you to listen to me. One of the greatest assets that you will ever have is parents or parent that love you enough to try to give you godly counsel in the form of when to say yes and when to say no. Are you listening to me? This is important. But there's going to come a time in your life where who used to keep your backside out of trouble, who helped you make decisions to keep you from getting in major problems, and right now it lines up with where you're going and you're kind of, I'm all right with that. There's going to come a time in your life where who has always had your back and has always looked out for you and has always given you good counsel, albeit at times you punished them for giving you good counsel because you acted like a brat and sulked and pouted and didn't want to come to dinner and did the stomp and turn and all the other things that you do as good little Christian kids. But nonetheless, you found out that, yeah, they were right. There's going to come a time where you're going to either have to be David or Saul, because I guarantee you there's going to come a time where you're going to want to do something and mom and dad are going to say, that's not best for you. And you know what you're going to have to do? You're going to have to say, let's see, who in this world has my back more and has a history consistently of giving me the right kind of counsel? That would probably be mom and dad. I mean, unless you're married to Ted Bundy and you can't be, he's dead. Unless you're married to some freakazoid, that would be, or your parents are a freakazoid, that would be your mom and dad. But the desire of your heart will be what you want so bad, you will override the good godly counsel. Saul had the same opportunity that David did. Saul could have in 1 Samuel 15 said, you know what? You are right. I am wrong. I'm going with you out there. We are going to fix this thing. We're talking about character. I do not like what you said and what you told me, but it is repercussions for something that I have done. I have lied. I did not perform the Lord's will like I was told to. And you're right. And he could have fixed it and God would have blessed it. And he would have stayed on the throne until he was done. And then David would have still stepped in. But Saul did what many of you will do and have done. Those that have given you good counsel Your desires, your emotions, your stinking hormones will say to you, but I want this and I want it now. And Mom and Dad say, not good for you. Wouldn't advise it. Here's where it gets dangerous. Now you get old enough that you want to, you can be emancipated from your parents. Now you're old enough to live on your own. And you're dealing with a real difficult decision. And so now you go in and you see the preacher and you're like, preacher, I'd like to talk to you. I don't need to talk to my mom and dad. I don't live at the house no more. And the preacher says, well, and you say, now, you know, preacher, the reason I'm in here is because you've always given me pretty good advice and stuff. And it's always been by the Bible. And I've always, no, what you're saying, you're setting me up now. I've always told you what you wanted to hear. So now what you want me to do is tell you what you want to hear. And when I tell you what you don't want to hear, well, I'm the Antichrist. And you're leaving the church. But the other scenario is, Mom and Dad say, it's not best for you. And in your little mind, for the moment where you are, you cannot make any sense. It don't make no sense at all. Why wouldn't they let me do that? I want to do this so bad. Mom and Dad won't let me do it. And then you get bitter. And then you get angry. And then you begin to let that stuff boil inside and it gets stuck in your craw. And then you get rebellious just like Saul was warned against. And up comes another spirit. And now from that point forward, no matter how good the counsel is, you can't hear from God anymore. Don't worry, I'm not going to go to all this other stuff. I'll be done when I'm done with this tonight. It'll just take me another hour and we're good to go. Now you can't hear from God in the preaching. Now you don't see it when you read your book. You're just so bitter. You're blinded by that spirit of bitterness. You're angry. You get to the point you're caught in that gall of bitterness, like in Acts chapter number 8, Simon the Sorcerer. You think, hey, I don't have to do that. I can buy it. I don't have to be it. I can purchase it. I can mimic it. I can camouflage it. I can act like it, but I'm really not. No, it's got you. You see, it can't be that simple. It absolutely can be. Because the time comes in everyone's life where God says to you, what are you going to do? Are you going to be David? Lord, I want to listen to you. David is going to cost you. You're going to be the king, but man, all the way out there in 2019, there's a boy out there at 3857. You know what he's going to do? He's going to use you as an illustration. You're going to bring up all the stuff you did, murder and adultery. And David says, well, have him bring it up, Lord, because you know what? At least if he gets to the end of the story, he'll see that I did what was right to do and I kept my fellowship with you in spite of what it cost me physically. Saul, the man out there, 3857, 2019, is going to use your life. Yeah, whatever. Yeah. Well, Saul, you wonder why you're down here in hell? It's that attitude right there. You wouldn't listen to me. He gave Saul numerous chances to repent, and he wouldn't do it. I don't know about you, but we're talking about character. We're talking about war and a good warfare. As a matter of fact, in the next verse down there, you find the word conscience mentioned, which is mentioned 47 times, I believe, in the New Testament. 42 of those are in Pauline epistles. It's connected. As crazy as I might sound, it is connected. But isn't it strange that you never consider it's your character being tested when it comes to your choices in life? Whether or not you should make certain decisions. It's not always grand theft or murder or robbery. Sometimes it's the infinitesimally small things about why you're mad, why you're angry, why you're bitter at somebody else. Sometimes it's that, like I mentioned earlier, that griping and complaining. Everything is wrong. And everybody around you is wrong. And everything you hear, you're thinking, they're attacking me. And you're defensive. And the Lord's like, they're not attacking you. You're under conviction, Saul. But here's what you don't understand about Saul. Have you ever noticed about Saul that he even turned on his own family? He turned against his own son, Jonathan. Am I right? Is that in the Bible? Not only that, the guy who literally drove the bad spirits out by playing his harp, the guy that helped him, was never against him. His son, Jonathan, asked him to come. So, look, I mean, you say whatever you want, but if that's your son's best friend, you're probably going to give him a little shine more so than others, right? I mean, he's in there with the prince. That's his best friend. But watch Saul's response to David just being seated at the table. He grabbed the javelin, and he tries to pin him to the wall. And he pursues David like a flea on a dog's back until the day of his death. You know why? Because Saul didn't have any character. And the only way he could even come close to looking like David was to always be attacking those that he thought were against him. Do you know in every one of Saul's conversations or confrontations after that, he was always looking for who's after him and who's out to get him and who's against him? And who's going to come against him and how he could wipe them out. Saul didn't trust anybody. You know what David said? Absalom's coming. Okay. Well, get a couple of them girls back there to get us some pots and pans and get us some water and stuff. And you know what? I started off in a field tending sheep. Graduated to a cave full of mud and water, dark. You know who my first people were around me? It wasn't all these people in the palace. It was those that were discouraged and discomfited and in debt. And I'm perfectly at home there. It's where I started. Back to my roots. I don't care. Let him have it. The palace ain't all it's cracked up to be anyway. As a matter of fact, you know, it's an amazing thing. When I was out there, I found out the Lord took more care of me, and I was more aware of the Lord taking care of me while I was out there than ever since I've been in the palace. It's like I forget it's the Lord taking care of me because everybody's doing such a good job taking care of me. So it might be good for me to go out, be outside the gate for a while. No big deal, let him have it. I'll go back. I know how to tend sheep. I got a job to fall back on. I'll tend some sheep. I'm not too good to do that. David, don't you want the throne? Nah. Not if he don't want me to have it. If the Lord don't want me to have it, I don't want it. I'll be jumped if I'm going to try to orchestrate something and make it to happen. I ain't doing it. That's what Saul does and what Saul did. Well, you know the end of the story. The illustration that you're talking about right there, war and a good warfare, ladies and gentlemen, the Lord is trying to say to you, it's still about choices. I ain't a Calvinist. Some of you, in spite of my little dissertation and maybe my little bedtime story tonight, some of you are right now grinding your teeth because you know what the Lord told you and somebody else told you, but you've already made up your mind and you don't care what God said and what that other person giving you counsel said. You're going to do what you want because you know what? You're going to be the exception to the rule. I watched a little girl. She just turned 18. She came to an individual that I know pretty well and said, let me ask you a question. You know, what's that? Well, I'm getting married and I'm leaving the house and I'm going to go so-and-so and he's going to be in the military and this and that and the other and everything's going to be wonderful and marvelous and outstanding and groovy. Well, said the man, might be a better idea to wait. Maybe let him get established and find out how the military works out and see how things go. And nothing doing. Thought you'd be interested to know. I said, well, what happened? He said, well, she wound up pregnant, had a child, lost the child. He wound up leaving her for some person he met while they were out on shore leave in some foreign place. He never was the same, he said. Looked off into the distance as if he was remembering when she was a little girl. I said, well, the little girl come from a rough upbringing? He said, no, she was raised in the church. He said, I was there when she was born. He said, but what happened to that little girl? He said, I've seen happen more than once. I said, "What's that, preacher?" He said, "She got too big to listen. And nobody could tell her. And the people that used to help her now became her enemies." And I immediately thought, well, I'll be. There's David trying to help Saul, and the very one that helped him, he wouldn't listen to David's God. So if you want a war, a good warfare, they tell me, I don't know if it's true, I think it is. Any great general is only as great as the counsel he receives, the information that's given him that he gathers. That makes a lot of sense. But he has to have the ability to discern the information. And at times, be willing to accept counsel, even if it is contrary to what he wants to do, if it lines up with what God wants him to do. Otherwise, you're going to wind up throwing javelins at everybody that disagrees with you, and you'll live the life of Saul. Let's stand together and be dismissed. I hope that helps you.